You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Words this morning are from Ralph Waldo Emerson, who writes, "To laugh often and much, to win the respect of the intelligent people and the affection of children, to earn the appreciation of honest critics and endure the betrayal of false friends, to appreciate beauty, to find the best in others, to leave the world a bit better, whether by a healthy child, a garden patch, or a redeemed social condition, to know that one life has breathed easier because you have lived here. This is to have succeeded." Welcome to our service this morning. My name is Peter Whittam, a member of this congregation, and we meet in the tradition of the many Unitarians who have worshipped here and at other places in the state since 1854. As you know, we meet on the land of the Kaurna people, who occupied this area for many thousands of years before European settlement. We respect their culture and traditions and honour their elders past and present. We start off with a story for all ages, and Janet Whittam will be taking that.
How the camel got his hump. Now this is the next tale, and it tells how the camel got his big hump.
We come now to our usual spot of candles of joy and concern. And if you have a joy or concern that you would like to share, you are quite welcome to come forward, light a candle, and share your joy or concern very briefly with the congregation. Or if you prefer, just light a silent. Could we have a few moments now of silent prayer or meditation? And whether we pray or meditate, this house will remain a unity. Take you back to the late 18th century. Revolution was in the air. In France, there was a general uprising of the population, which resulted in the storming of the Bastille in 1789. Also, the declaration of the First French Republic in 1792, the subsequent execution of Louis XVI in early 1793, and the subsequent Reign of Terror. In Britain, the ideals of the revolution were finding fertile ground. There was widespread discontent founded on poverty, unemployment, hunger, and a life expectancy somewhere short of 40. Not surprisingly, the British government under William Pitt viewed the situation in France with some trepidation. especially with the rise to power of Napoleon Bonaparte and the fear of a French invasion. The British government viewed with great suspicion anyone who espoused revolutionary ideals. Many came under the surveillance of government agents. Joseph Priestley was one, and the Reverend Fish Palmer, a Dundee Unitarian minister, was another. A mob burnt Priestley's home and laboratory to the ground, causing him to flee to America. Palmer found himself transported to New South Wales, convicted of editing a pamphlet which supported revolutionary ideals of democracy and social reform. Amid all this political fervour, we find the first of the Romantic poets, William Wordsworth and Samuel Taylor Coleridge. These two spent the years 1797 and 1798, their most fruitful, poetically speaking, living in the same village, near the Stowey, in North Somerset, on the edge of the Quantock Hills. They would often go for long rambles in the Quantocks, discussing the classic English poets and coming up with their own versions of their approach to the muse. These walks culminated in the publication in 1798 of their radical collection of poetry under the title Lyrical Ballads. The leading poem in the volume is The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, and those of you who are in the congregation a few weeks ago will know a bit more about that, wherein Coleridge begins to explore the metaphysical world and moral truths. This poem, as well as the Gothic Christabel and the later published fantasy Kubla Khan, have an ethereal quality, partly on account of the dreamlike atmosphere they evoke, and partly because in the case of the latter two poems, they were never finished. These three poems begin to provide an opening into Coleridge's philosophy, bringing forward ideas opposing the prevailing philosophical views which saw the universe as mechanistically materialist. But let us pause to have a look into Coleridge's background. Born the 14th son of the vicar of Ottery St Mary in Devon and schooled at Christ's Hospital in London, he became proficient in Greek, Latin and Hebrew. At Jesus College, Cambridge from 1791, he absorbed not only Greek texts, but also English political writings. Cambridge at that time was a hotbed of political radicalism, not unlike the Cambridge of the 1930s and 40s. At Cambridge, Coleridge was active in support of William Friend, a Unitarian and fellow of Jesus College, who had been expelled for his pamphlet Peace and Union in 1793. The pamphlet called upon the contending parties in our own country to make proper use of the divine judgments and, instead of exasperating each other by useless invectives, to unite cordially in their endeavours to promote the common good and to remove those grievances, if any such there be, which occasion the present discontent. Friend had been converted from Anglicanism to Unitarianism in 1788. He was the author of many works, one of which urged people to turn away from the false worship of three persons to the worship of the one true God. Because of financial difficulties, or perhaps on account of a failed love affair, or probably both, Coleridge left Cambridge without taking a degree. Surprisingly, for someone who espoused radical anti-government sentiments, he joined a cavalry regiment, albeit under an assumed name. However, his friends and his brothers soon found out about it, and they managed to buy him out of the army. With the French Revolution, with its political and social turmoil in full swing, Coleridge sought a means of getting away from the violence which had laid waste to the ideals of the revolution. To this end, he planned, with the poet Robert Southey, a pantisocracy, a utopian society, to be set up in Pennsylvania. This would be a model egalitarian community which would organise itself and adopt principles of social justice. However, one has the distinct impression that equality would prevail in the animal farm sense. That is, all are equal, but some are more equal than others. And the others probably included the women, who would do all the work while the men devoted themselves to intellectual pursuits. One detects a certain amount of hypocrisy here. not unlike the outlook of Henry David Thoreau, who espoused the virtue of rural natural life in the woods of Walden, but took his washing home to his mother on the weekends. In pursuit of this utopian dream, Coleridge, with Southey, moved to Bristol in 1795 and gave public lectures in support of their ideas. During this time, he also preached to a number of Unitarian congregations, among them the Nottingham Unitarians. And in this context, I'm wondering if some of my forebears were actually in the congregation on that occasion. As this utopian concept called for participants to be family men, Southey and Coleridge married the Fricker sisters, Edith and Sarah, daughters of a local schoolmistress. However, the improvident Coleridge soon found that he needed to temper his intellectual ideas with financial reality. And it was in 1795 that Coleridge met Wordsworth. The two poets, Coleridge with his young family and Wordsworth with his sister Dorothy, took up separate residences in Nether Stowey. This was in June 1797, shortly after Coleridge had been preaching at the Unitarian Chapel in Bridgewater in Somerset. Wordsworth and Coleridge were visited in Nether Stowey by various radical activists, among them a John Thelwall. Thelwall was the target of the Pitt regime. Government agents had dogged him for at least 5 years, consistently reporting his anti-government speeches. He'd been arrested in 1794 on the grounds of treasonable practices. However, at trial, the Crown was unable to prove its case, and he had been freed. He was, however, constrained from giving lectures on English politics, so he began to give talks on the inadequacies of the Roman constitution. Fairly transparent, one would think. Thelwall's visit did nothing to quell government fears about our romantic poets. Both Wordsworth and Coleridge were friendly with Thomas Poole, a local self-educated tanner, who was also a confirmed advocate of the democratic cause. Poole had attracted the attention of the Home Office, who viewed him as a revolutionary agitator. Not surprisingly, some of that attention became directed to the two poets. Was there to be a Bastille in the Quantocks? It was noteworthy that most of the other romantic poets who followed Coleridge and Wordsworth, including John Keats, Leigh Hunt, George Gordon, a.k.a. Lord Byron, Percy Bysshe Shelley, and Robert Southey, were also viewed as subversives by the establishment. Hunt even spent 2 years in Surrey County Jail for editing a subversive publication. Coleridge suffered acute arthritic pain for most of his life. The general remedy in those days was laudanum. Laudanum is a mixture of opium and brandy, and over time Coleridge became addicted. His Gothic fantasy, Kubla Khan, was composed on one of his walks, this time alone and possibly suffering from dysentery, when he stayed at a farmhouse between Porlock and Linton in North Devon. This was in the autumn of 1797. He later wrote that Kubla Khan was composed in a sort of reverie brought on by 2 grains of opium, a dream stimulated by his extensive readings about exotic and far-off places, especially the palace and estate of the Mongol Empire of the Great Khan, as well as his own opium addiction. The poem, as I've mentioned, was never finished. Coleridge claimed that a visitor from Porlock had disturbed him before he could write down all that he had composed. He travelled to Shropshire in December 1797, having been offered a post as locum tenens to Dr. Rowe, who was the minister of the High Street Unitarian Chapel in Shrewsbury. This post offered financial stability and a purposeful career. He gave a probationary sermon on January the 14th, 1798, at the chapel. In the congregation was a young poet, William Hazlitt, son of a dissenting minister in Wem, who walked the 15 kilometres, or as he wrote, 10 miles, from his home to attend. Hazlitt had been aware of Coleridge for some time, and in the words of Adam Nicholson, worshipped him from afar. Coleridge, showing his colours plainly, used his sermon to denounce the Anglican Church and the British government and their wicked collusion in a wicked campaign against the French, and so on in the same vein. And you've heard from the reading how impressed young Hazlitt was on hearing Coleridge's address. However, Coleridge's venture into the ministry was to be short-lived. His friend Tom Wedgwood, of the famous and very wealthy Pottery family, wrote to him offering an annuity of £150 a year if he chose not to become a minister and instead devote himself to poetry and philosophy. And I don't know quite what the reason for that was, but I haven't been able to discover that. Maybe he didn't like the way he preached. Anyway, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. And in the event, Coleridge did not take long to accept the offer and return to Nether Stowey. However, he did in the spring of 1798 temporarily take over the Unitarian pulpit of the Reverend Joshua Toulmin in the Mary Street Unitarian Chapel in Taunton, while the minister took leave to mourn the drowning death of his daughter, Jane. As observed earlier, Coleridge and Wordsworth published their lyrical ballads in 1798, with the Rime of the Ancient Mariner as the leading poem, and for which Coleridge is best known. At the end of 1798, Coleridge left his family in England and spent a year in Germany, learning the language and translating the works of philosopher Immanuel Kant, and in doing so became inspired by European transcendentalist ideas. Becoming disillusioned by the failure of democracy in France and the coming to power of Napoleon, Coleridge began to rethink his political radicalism. For Coleridge, radicalism in politics and rationalism in religion went hand in hand, and so he was, at the same time, reconsidering his Unitarianism. In fact, he abandoned Unitarianism in 1814 and returned to the Church of England. Over the next two decades, he wrote a number of publications setting out his theories of imagination and symbolism. These included his Aids to Reflection, published in 1825, and On the Constitution of the Church and State, published in 1829. He sided with those who supported the spiritual and transcendent, that is, the view that God has a continuous existence outside the created world, against those who maintain the reality and immanent nature of God. Put in another way, he argued for the transcendence of God rather than the pantheistic concept of God being present throughout the universe, as was maintained by the 17th century Dutch philosopher Baruch Spinoza. He argued that the pursuit of economic improvement, very much evident in this era at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, with its advances in technology, had led to a decline in culture, tradition, and spiritual well-being. He warned of a society that was perilously over-civilized, varnished rather than polished, and most pitiably uncultivated. This was an important tenet in what John Stuart Mill, an admirer of Coleridge, called the Germano-Coleridgian school. The group studied what the prevailing utilitarian and materialist philosophers, such as Jeremy Bentham, overlooked, namely that socially and psychologically significant meanings embedded in religion and cultural symbolism. In Peter Cheney's words, Coleridge championed cultural and spiritual concerns and opposed the ethical elevation of sensual pleasure. Drawing on the transcendentalism of Kant and what Peter Cheney describes as the even obscurer intricacies of post-Kantians, his philosophy was undoubtedly of the difficult metaphysical kind, very much at odds with the prevailing practically minded British empiricism. So obscure that Lord Byron was moved to write, "Explaining metaphysics to the nation, I wish he would explain his explanation." Coleridge's writings and ideas found their way across the Atlantic to New England, where they found fertile ground amongst a group of Unitarians who effectively became known as Transcendentalists. Now, I have found it very difficult to sort out an easily understandable definition of Transcendentalism, and the best one I've been able to come up with is something like adherence to an idealistic system of thought based on a belief in the essential unity of all creation, the innate goodness of humanity, and the supremacy of insight over logic and experience for the revelation of deepest truths. Now, that's one definition, but there are many, and it depends on who you talk to who will give you another one. Foremost among the transcendentalists was the young Ralph Waldo Emerson, who in 1833 took the long sea crossing to Europe to meet his literary heroes, Coleridge among them. The meeting with Coleridge was a deep disappointment to Emerson, who found him now in his 60s to be old and preoccupied. Emerson was surprised to learn that Coleridge now deprecated his previous Unitarian ideals, going so far as to say that he had once been a Unitarian and knew what quackery it was. Coleridge dominated the interview for a whole hour, hardly letting Emerson get a word in. In this context, I read an article by Dr. Philip Hewitt, who was an interim minister here some years ago. He noted that Coleridge, although he had left Unitarianism far behind, continued to dress like a minister and was sometimes taken for one. He no longer had a pulpit, but continued to address his hearers in long monologues. On one occasion, he said to his friend Charles Lamb, "I think you never heard me preach," to which Lamb retorted, "I've never heard you do anything else." And so, like many young radicals, Coleridge had become more conservative as he aged, much like many erstwhile student activists who later in life have become captains of industry or merchant bankers, wearing collars, ties and three-piece suits. As Emerson found to his disillusionment, Coleridge had very much returned to his orthodox religion of his upbringing. Closing words are from the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. "Farewell, farewell, but this I tell to thee, thou wedding guest. He prayeth well who loveth well both man and bird and beast. He prayeth best who loveth best all things, both great and small. For the dear God who loveth us, he made and loveth all."
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianSA@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians. Thank you.
Thank you, Margaret, for lovely music this morning.